smile and English good manners was obviously the uncommunicative type.
Now then, when you saw the girls crossing the creek, did you recognize any of them?
How could I? I've only been in Australia for about 3 weeks, and I haven't met any young girls.
I see. Did you have any conversation with any of these girls, either before or after they crossed the opposite bank?
Certainly not. I've just told you, Constable, I didn't even know any of them by sight.
At which guileless reply, the constable permitted himself a dry grin, adding mentally,
"Stone the crows, with that face and all that money."
He asked, "How about Crundle? Did he speak to any of these girls?"
"No, only stared and whistled at them."
"What were your uncle and aunt doing while this was going on?"
"As far as I can remember, they were both dozing. We had champagne for lunch, and I suppose it made them sleepy."
"What effect does champagne have on you?" asked the policeman, pencil in air.
"None, as far as I know. I don't drink much, at any time, and when I do, it's usually wine. You know, at home."
"Well then, you were perfectly clear in the head and sitting with a book under a tree when you saw them crossing the creek. Now, suppose you go on from there. Just try and remember any little detail, even if it seems unimportant now. You understand, of course, this is an entirely voluntary statement on your part."
"I watched them crossing the creek."
He swallowed and went on again in an almost inaudible voice.
"They all did it differently."
"Speak up, please. How do you mean differently? Ropes? Vaulting poles?"
"Heavens, no. I only meant some of them were more agile, you know, more graceful."
Bumper, however, was not at this moment concerned with grace. The young man continued.
"Anyway, as soon as we were out of earshot, I got up and I went over to speak to Albert, who was washing some glasses at the creek. We had a bit of a talk, for perhaps 10 minutes, and I said I would take a little stroll before it was time to go home."
"What time was it then?" "I didn't look at my watch, but I knew my uncle wanted to leave not later than 4 o'clock. I began walking towards the hanging rock. By the time it began to go uphill, there was some bracken fern and bushes, and the girls were already out of sight. I remember thinking the scrub looked pretty thick for girls to tackle in light summer dresses, and I expected to see them coming down any minute. I sat down for a few minutes on a fallen tree. When Albert called out, I came back to the pool immediately, mounted the Arab pony and rode home, most of the way behind my uncle's wagonette. I can't think of anything else. Will that do?" "Nicely. Thank you, Mr. Fitzhubert.
We may get you to help us again later." Michael groaned inwardly. The brief interview had been a fairly close imitation of a dentist drill boring into a sensitive cavity. "Only one more thing I'd like to check up on before we get it written down," the policeman was saying. "You mentioned seeing 3 girls crossing the creek. Is that correct?"
"I'm sorry. You're right. Of course, there were 4 girls.
Bumper's pencil was hovering again.
"What made you forget there were 4 of them, do you think?"
"Because I forgot the little fat one, I suppose."
"So you looked pretty closely at the other 3, did you?"
"No, I didn't. God help me, it's the truth. I only looked at her."
"I suppose you would have remembered if there was an elderly lady with them."
Michael, looking irritated, said,
"Of course I would. There was no one else. Only the four girls.
While this was going on, Albert, at the Wood End police station, was giving his statement to one Jim Grant, the young policeman who had been out to Appleyard College with Bumpfer on Sunday morning. Unlike Michael, Albert, fairly well used to the twists and turns which a policeman can give to the most innocent remarks, was rather enjoying himself, being officially acquainted with young Grant through the trifling matter of a Sunday cockfight.
"I've told you, Jim," he was saying, "I only seen them Sheilas the once. I'll trouble you not to call me Jim when I'm on duty," said the other, who had reached the perspiring stage of exasperation. "It don't smell good in the force. Now then, how many girls did you see crossing that creek?"
"All right, Mr. Bloody Grant, four. There's no call for swearing, neither. I'm only performing my duty."
"I suppose you know," said the coachman, producing a small bag of caramels and ostentatiously sucking one in a hollow tooth, "that this is a statement, what I give to the police free, gratis, and for nothing. I'm only doing it to oblige, and don't you forget it, Mr. Grant." Jim resisted the peace offering of a caramel and continued.
"What did you do after Mr. Fitzhubert started to walk towards the rock?"
"The colonel wakes up and starts hollering it's time to go, and I goes after Mr. Michael, and blow me if he isn't sitting down on a log and the Sheilas out of sight."
"About how far from the pool would you say this log be?"
"Look, Jim, you know as well as I do, the bloody police and everyone else know the exact spot. I showed it to Mr. Bumpfer himself last Sunday."
"All right, I'm only ascertaining the facts. Go on."
"Anyway, Michael gets on that Arab pony what his uncle lets him ride and rides home to Lakeview."
"The little beaut. I'll say some people are lucky. Gee, Albert, you couldn't get the Honourable Who's This to give me a loan of it to show at Gisborne. Nothing to beat that pony for 50 miles round here. Mind you, I wouldn't be wanting the saddle and the bridle. Just the mount for the afternoon. The Colonel knows I haven't bad hands on a horse."
"If you think I've come all the way down here from Lakeview to scrounge a ride on the Arab for you," said Albert, rising, "no more questions? Then I'll be off. Ta-ta."
"Hi, wait a moment. There is one more," cried Jim, making a pass at the other's coattails. "When Mr. Fitzhubert mounted this pony of his, you say he rode home to Lakeview with the wagonette. Did you actually see him all the way?"
"I haven't got eyes in the back of me bloody head. He rode behind us some of the way so as we wouldn't get his dust, and some of the way he was ahead, according to the road. I didn't take that much notice except that we all arrived at the front gates of Lakeview at the same time."
"What time was that, do you think?"
"Round about 7:30 it must have been. I remember cook had my dinner waiting in the oven."
"Thank you, Mr. Crundall."
The young policeman closed his notebook with some formality.
"This interview will be written out in full and shown to you later for your approval. You may go now."
The permission was superfluous. Albert was already slipping the bridle over the head of a strawberry cob tethered in a patch of clover on the opposite side of the road. For 3 consecutive mornings, the Australian public had been devouring, along with its bacon and eggs, the luscious details of the College Mystery, as it was now known to the press. Although no further information had been unearthed and nothing resembling a clue, so that the situation remained unchanged since the girls and their governess had been reported missing by Ben Hussey late on Saturday night. The public must be fed. To this end, some additional spice had been added to Wednesday's column's photograph of the Honourable Michael's ancestral home, Haddingham Hall, inset of sisters playing with spaniel on terrace, and of course Irma Leopold's beauty and reputed millions on coming of age. Bumper, however, was far from satisfied with all this. After consultation with his friend, Detective Lugg, based at Russell Street, he had decided to make yet another attempt to extract something in the way of concrete evidence from the schoolgirl, Edith Horton. Accordingly, at 8 o'clock on the morning of Wednesday the 18th, another glorious day lightened by a gay little breeze, he had arrived at Appleyard College in a buggy and pair with young Jim in attendance, for the purpose of driving Edith Horton and the French governess to the picnic grounds at Hanging Rock. Mrs. Appleyard, although the arrangement smacked vaguely of frivolity, could hardly object. The police, said Bumper, were doing their utmost to clear up the mystery, and in his opinion, and that of Detective Lugg, it was essential that Edith, as a key witness, should be confronted with the actual scene as a spur to memory. The headmistress, aware of Edith's limited intelligence and unlimited obstinacy, plus a possible mild concussion, thought the expedition a waste of time and said so to Bumper, who bluntly disagreed. Despite a rather unprepossessing manner, Bumper was no fool at his job and had a great deal of experience in the way different people react under police questioning. He told her, "All of us trying to make this girl remember may have got her more bamboozled than ever. I've known people with shocking memories to turn into quite useful witnesses once they get back to where they started, so to speak. We'll try and take it easy this time." And so, with a relaxing atmosphere in mind, the constable had allowed himself to enjoy the drive with Mademoiselle sitting up beside him, smart and pretty, in a shady hat, and had even shouted her a brandy and soda and Edith and young Jim a lemonade while they were changing horses at the hotel in Wood End. Now they were standing at the exact spot on the picnic ground where Edith and the three girls had crossed the creek by the pool on the afternoon of St. Valentine's Day. Straight ahead, on the sunlit face of the Hanging Rock, the forest branches threw faintly stirring patterns of shade. "Like blue lace," thought Mademoiselle, wondering how anything so beautiful could be the instrument of evil.
"Now then, Miss Edith," the policeman was well away, all smiles and fatherly patience, "in which direction do you say you began walking the other day when you started off from this very spot?"
"I don't say. I told you before, one gum tree's the same as another to me."
"Edith, chérie," put in Mademoiselle, "perhaps you could tell the sergeant what you four girls were chattering of just then." "I am sure they were chattering, Mr. Bumper."
"That's right," said the policeman. "That's the idea. Miss Edith, did anyone suggest which way they wanted to go?"
"Marion Quaid was teasing me. Marion can be very disagreeable sometimes. She said those peaky things up there were a million years old."
"The peaks? So you were walking towards the peaks?"
"I suppose so. My feet were hurting and I didn't pay much attention. I wanted to sit down on a fallen tree instead of going on, but the others wouldn't let me."
Bumper threw a hopeful glance at Mademoiselle. There were a number of logs and fallen branches scattered about, but at least a fallen tree was something concrete to work from.
"Now that you've remembered about the log, Miss Edith,
Perhaps you'll think of something else. Just take a look around from here and see if there's anything at all that you can recognize. Stumps, ferns, queer-shaped stones.
No, said Edith. There isn't.
Ah, well, never mind,
said the policeman, resolving to renew the attack after lunch.
Where would you like to eat our sandwiches, mademoiselle?
Jim was sent back to the buggy for the lunch boxes, and they had just made themselves comfortable on the grass when Edith volunteered, apropos of nothing,
Mr. Bumfer, there is one thing I seem to remember.
Fine. What was it?
A cloud. A funny sort of cloud.
A cloud? Fine. Except that clouds, unfortunately, have a way of moving from one place to another in the sky, you know.
I'm quite aware of that, said Edith, all at once prim and grown up. Only this one was a nasty red colour, and I remember it because I looked up and saw it through some branches.
Slowly, she took a large bite of ham sandwich.
It was just after I passed Miss McCraw.
Bumfer's own sandwich fell unnoticed on the grass.
Miss McCraw? Stone the Crows? You never told us you saw Miss McCraw. Jim, get the notebook.
I don't know if you realize, Miss Edith, that what you have just told me is very important.
That's why I'm telling you, said Edith smugly.
When did your teacher join up with you and the other three girls? Think very hard, please.
She's not my teacher, said Edith, taking another bite of the sandwich. My mama didn't want me to do senior mathematics. She says a girl's place is in the home.
Bumfer had somehow produced an ingratiating grin.
Quite so. A very sensible lady, your mother. Now, go on, please, about Miss McCraw. Where was she when you suddenly looked up and saw her? Close by? A long way off?
She seemed to be quite a long way off.
100 yards? 50 yards?
I don't know. I'm not much good at sums. I told you. I only saw her in the distance, through the trees, as I was running back to the creek.
You were running downhill, of course.
Of course.
And Miss McCraw was walking uphill, in the opposite direction. Is that correct?
To his dismay, the witness had begun to wiggle and giggle.
Oh, mercy! She did look so funny.
Why? Asked Bumfer. Get this down, Jim. Why did she look so funny?
I'd rather not say.
Please tell us, Edith, Mademoiselle coaxed. You're giving Mr. Bumfer such valuable help.
Her skirt,
said Edith, stuffing the corner of her handkerchief in her mouth. What about her skirt? Edith was giggling again.
It's much too rude to say out loud in mixed company.
Bumfer was leaning towards her as if his keen blue eyes could bore a hole in her brain tissues.
You don't need to mind about me. I'm old enough to be your dad. That's the idea.
Edith was whispering something into Mademoiselle's attentive little pink ear.
She says, Constable, that Miss McGraw was not wearing the skirt, only le pantalons.
Drawers, the constable instructed young Jim. Now then, Miss Edith, you are positive this woman you saw in the distance walking uphill through the trees was really Miss McCraw?
Positive?
Wasn't it a bit hard to recognize her without her dress?
Not at all. None of the other teachers are such a peculiar shape. Irma Leopold once told me the McCraw is exactly the same shape as a flat iron.
And that was the last and only piece of factual information to be extracted from Edith Horton, either on Wednesday, February the 18th, or on any subsequent occasion. As soon as the police buggy had turned out of the drive onto the high road, Mrs. Appleyard had sat down resolutely at her desk and locked the study door. It was becoming a habit. As she went about her business, erect, uncommunicative, outwardly unperturbed, she was increasingly aware of a rising murmur of questioning voices from the outside world. Voices of cranks, clergymen, clairvoyants, journalists, friends, relations, parents. Parents, of course, were the worst. One could hardly toss their letters into the waste paper basket, as one could the offer, with stamped envelope enclosed, to find the missing girls with a patent magnet. A hard core of common sense told her it was reasonable enough, even for a parent whose daughter had returned from the picnic safe and well, to write for further information and reassurance. These were the letters that kept her chained and chafing at her desk for hours at a time. An indiscreet word addressed to an overwrought mother might easily at this stage set off a conflagration of lies and rumours that no amount of hosing down with the icy waters of truth could extinguish. Mrs. Appleyard's task this morning was the odious and infinitely more dangerous one of writing to inform the parents of Miranda and Irma Leopold and the legal guardian of Marion Quaid that all three girls and a governess had mysteriously disappeared from the Hanging Rock. Fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, none of the three letters would reach their destination without considerable delay. Nor would any of the recipients have had access to the published reports of the college mystery, for reasons to be presently disclosed. Again her thoughts reverted to the morning of the picnic. Again she saw the orderly rows of girls in hats and gloves, the two mistresses in perfect control. Again she heard her own brief words of farewell on the porch, warning of dangerous snakes and insects. Insects! What in the name of heaven had happened on Saturday afternoon? And why had it happened to three senior girls so valuable to the prestige and social standing of Appleyard College? Marion Quaid, a brilliant scholar, though not wealthy like the other two, could be counted on for academic laurels, almost equally important in their way. Why couldn't it have been Edith who had disappeared, or that little nobody Blanche, or Sarah Wayborn? As usual, the very thought of Sarah Wayborn was an irritant. Those great saucer eyes, holding a perpetual unspoken criticism intolerable in a child of 13. However, Sarah's fees were always promptly paid by an elderly guardian whose private address was never divulged. Discreet, elegant, obviously a gentleman, as her Arthur would have put it. The memory of Arthur, standing at her elbow, as he often did while she struggled with a difficult piece of correspondence, wiped the elegant guardian from her mind. All this was getting her nowhere. With something like a groan, she took up a thin, steel-nibbed pen and began to write. First, to the Leopolds, undoubtedly the most impressive parents on the college register, fabulously rich and moving in the best international society, but now in India, where Mr. Leopold was buying polo ponies from a Rajah in Bengal. According to Irma's last letter, her parents would at this moment be somewhere in the Himalayas, on a frantic expedition with elephants and palanquins and silk-embroidered tents. Address for at least a fortnight. Unknown. At last the letter was completed to the writer's satisfaction, a judicious blend of sympathy and practical common sense. Not too much sympathy, in case by the time it was received the whole damnable business had been satisfactorily cleared up and Irma back at school. A problem, too, whether or not to touch on the black tracker and the bloodhound. She could almost hear Arthur's, "Masterly, my dear, masterly." And so, according to its purpose, we may be sure it was. Next, in order of precedence, came Miranda's mother and father, owners of vast cattle stations in the back blocks of northern Queensland. Not quite in the millionaire class, but entrenched in a setting of solid wealth and well-being as members of one of Australia's best-known pioneer families. Exemplary parents who could be relied on not to fuss over trifles of missed trains or an epidemic of measles at the college, but in this preposterous situation, as unpredictable as anyone else. Miranda was the only girl, the eldest of five children, and, well, Mrs. Appleyard knew it, the apple of her parents' eye. The whole family had been staying at St. Kilda during the Christmas holidays, but had returned last month to the luxurious isolation of Goonawindi. Only a few days ago, Miranda had happened to mention that the Goonawindi mail arrived with the stores, sometimes only once in 4 or 5 weeks. However, one could never be sure, thought the headmistress, sucking on the nib, that some busybody of a visitor wouldn't come riding over with the newspapers and let the cat out of the mailbag. As will have been noted, Mrs. Appleyard was not prone to sentiment, yet this was the hardest letter she had ever been obliged to write in her whole life. As she gummed down the flap of the envelope, the closely written pages proclaimed themselves the messengers of doom. She shrugged. "I am becoming fanciful," and took a nip or two of brandy from the cupboard behind the desk. Marion Quade's lawful guardian was a family solicitor, very much in the background except for the payment of Marion's fees. By good fortune, he was at present in New Zealand, on a fishing trip at some inaccessible lake. In Mrs. Appleyard's hearing, her guardian had lately been referred to by Marion as a dodderer. With the fervent hope that the solicitor would live up to his reputation and let sleeping dogs lie until further information came to hand, the letter was signed and sealed. And finally, another to the octogenarian father of Greta McCraw, living alone with his dog and his Bible on a remote island in the Hebrides. The old man was unlikely to make trouble or even communicate, having never penned his daughter a line since her arrival in Australia as a girl of 18. All four letters were stamped and laid on the hall table for Tom to post on tonight's train. 6. On the afternoon of Thursday, February the 19th, Michael Fitzhubert and Albert Crundall were seated in amicable silence before a bottle of Ballarat bitter in the little rustic boathouse fronting Colonel Fitzhubert's ornamental lake. Albert was off duty for an hour or two, and Mike was taking a temporary respite from assisting at his aunt's annual garden party. The lake was deep and dark, icy cold, despite the languorous summer heat, overgrown at one end with water lilies, whose creamy cups caught and held the rays of the late afternoon sun. On a patch of lily pads, a single white swan was standing on one coral leg, now and then sending out showers of concentric ripples across the surface of the lake. On the opposite side, Banks of tree ferns and blue hydrangea mingled with the natural forest rising steeply behind the low verandaed house, on whose lawns the guests were strolling under the elms and oaks. Two maids behind a trestle table were serving strawberries and cream. It was rather a smart party, including guests from nearby Government Cottage, the summer residence of the state governor, with a hired footman, three musicians from Melbourne, and plenty of French champagne. There had earlier been talk of putting the coachman into a tight black jacket for service at the champagne bar, to which Albert had replied that he was hired to look after the horses. "As I said to your uncle, I'm a coachman, sir, not a bloody waiter." Mike laughed. "You look like a sailor, with those mermaids and things tattooed all over your arms." "A sailor done 'em for me, in Sydney. Wanted to do me chest too, but I ran out of cash. Pity, I was only 15. Transported to a world where boys of 15 cheerfully spent their last shilling on being thus disfigured for life, Mike gazed at his friend with something like awe. He himself at 15 had been hardly more than a child, with a shilling a week pocket money and another for the plate on Sunday mornings. Since the afternoon of the picnic, a comfortable, non-demanding friendship had developed between the two young men. To see them now, Albert, loose of limb in rolled-up shirt sleeves and moleskin trousers, Michael, stiff in garden party attire, with a carnation in his buttonhole, they looked an ill-sorted pair. "Mike's all right," Albert had told his friend the cook. "Him and me are mates." And so, in the finest sense of that much-abused word, they were. The fact that Albert, who had just tried his friend's grey topper on, his own tousled bullet head, looked like a music hall turn, and that Mike, in Albert's wide-brimmed, greasy sundowner, might have stepped from the pages of The Magnet or Boy's Own Paper, meant less than nothing. As did the accident of birth that had rendered one of them almost illiterate and the other barely articulate. At the age of 20, a public school education being by no means a guarantee of adult expression. In each other's presence, neither young man was conscious of his shortcomings, if such they were. There was a cozy sense of mutual understanding, and not too much talk. Topics of conversation were mainly of local interests, when they arose, the mare's off-hind leg, which Albert was painting with Stockholm tar, or the Colonel's obstinate enthusiasm for the time-wasting rose garden that called for more bloody weeding than an acre of spuds, and anyway, what was the good of all of them roses? Neither had anything much in the way of embarrassing political, or for that matter any other kind of convictions, which they would have recognised as their own if shown them written down in cold print. Which in friendship makes everything simpler. There was no obstructive nonsense, for instance, in Mike's father being a conservative member of the English House of Lords, while Albert's, last heard of, was an itinerant rouseabout in perpetual strife with the boss of the shed. For Albert, young FitzHubert was the ideal companion, sitting silently for hours on an upturned chaff box in the stable yard, drinking in the other's native wisdom and wit. Some of Albert's more hair-raising anecdotes were true, others not. It made no odds. For Mike, the coachman's free-roving conversation was a continual source of pleasurable instruction, not only about life in general, but Australia. In the Lakeview kitchen, the Honourable Michael, a member of one of the oldest and richest families in the United Kingdom, was commonly referred to as "that poor English bastard," an expression of genuine compassion for one who obviously had so much to learn.
"Cripes," said Cook, whose wages were considered good at 25 shillings a week. "I wouldn't be him, not for a cartload of nuggets."
Meanwhile, in the drawing room, Mike was telling his uncle and aunt,
"Albert's such a jolly good chap, and so clever. I can't tell you what a lot he knows about all sorts of things."
I don't doubt it," the Colonel agreed with a wink. "Rough as bags, young Crundle, but no fool and a first-rate man with the horses."
His wife sniffed, almost breathing in the hay and horse dung.
"I can't imagine that Crundle's conversation would be exactly edifying."
In the cool peace of the boathouse this afternoon, there was precious little conversation, edifying or otherwise. What with a bottle of cold beer and a lake to look upon, placid under its pattern of slowly lengthening shadows. In the distance, the blue Danube drifted over the water from the rose garden as the party grew duller and cooler. The roses, admired to excess, were no longer conversationally adequate. The Colonel, with two or three chosen males, had retreated under the weeping elm armed with tumblers of scotch and soda, while Mrs. Fitzhubert held the rest of the party together as best she could on lemonade.
"Confound it! It's gone 5 already!"
Michael was reluctantly unwinding his long legs from under the table. "I promised my aunt I'd show Miss Stack the rose garden before they go."
"Stack? That the one with the pair of legs like champagne bottles?"
Mike had no idea, the unknown Miss Stack's legs being of no moment whatsoever.
"I seen her getting out of the government cottage dog cart this afternoon. Geez, that reminds me. The groom was telling me the cops had the bloodhounds out at Hanging Rock again today."
"Good God," exclaimed the other, sitting down again. "What for? Have they found anything new?"
"No bloody fear. What I say is this, if them Russell Street blokes and the Abbo tracker and the bloody dog can't find them, what's the sense of you and me worrying our guts out?"
"We may as well finish the bottle. Plenty of other people have got themselves bushed before today, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the stone end of it."
Mike was staring out at the shining disk of the lake. He said slowly,
"As far as I'm concerned, it's not the end of it. I wake up in a cold sweat every night wondering if they're still alive, dying of thirst somewhere on that infernal rock at this very minute, while you and I are sitting here drinking cold beer."
If Michael's young sisters had heard the low, impassioned voice, so different to his usual clipped and breezy utterance, they would hardly have recognized the brother, whose confidences at home, if any, were reserved for an elderly cocker spaniel.
"That's where you and me is different," Albert was saying. "If you take my advice, the sooner you forget the whole thing, the better."
"I can't forget it. I never will."
The white swan, poised all this time on the lily pads, now chose to stretch one pink leg and then the other and go flapping away across the lake towards the opposite bank. The two young men watched its flight in silence until it disappeared amongst the reeds.
"Ah, they're pretty birds, all right, them swans," Albert breathed.
"Beautiful," Mike said, miserably aware of the strange young woman awaiting him in the rose garden. Painfully, he unwound his long, pinstriped legs from under the rustic seat, stood up, blew his nose, lit a cigarette, got as far as the door of the boathouse, stopped, and turned round again.
"Listen," said Albert. "I'm no great shakes on music, but isn't that God Save the Queen? The Gov must be leaving."
I don't care if he is. There's something I must say to you, but I don't know how to begin.
Albert had never seen him look so serious.
As a matter of fact, I've been working out a plan.
It'll keep, Albert said, lighting a cigarette.
Better hop it, hadn't you? Your auntie'll raise hell if you're not on show.
Confound my aunt. The point is, it won't keep. It's now or never to be any use. You know that bridal track you were telling me about yesterday?
Albert nodded.
You mean the one that takes you down the plains on our side of the mount?
I dare say it sounds a wild goose chase to you, and maybe it is, but I don't care. I've decided to make a search of the rock on my own, in my own way. No police, no bloodhounds, just you and me.
That is, if you'll come along and show me the ropes. We could take the Arab and the Lancer, get off an early start, and be home here for dinner without any awkward questions.
Now then, I've got it off my chest. How about it?
Barmy! Nuts! You run along and show Miss Bottle Legs them roses, and you and me have a yarn about it some other time.
Now, I know what you're thinking, said the other, with such bitterness that Albert was quite shaken.
Hi, wait a bit. Mike, I was only meaning...
You're thinking, poor bastard's a new chum in the bush and so on. Hell, I know all that, but it doesn't matter. I lied to you just now about a plan. It's really not so much a plan as a feeling.
Albert's eyebrows flew up, but he said nothing.
All my life, I've been doing things because other people said they were the right things to do. This time, I'm going to do something because I say so, even if you and everyone else thinks I'm mad.
It's like this, Albert said. Feelings is all very well, but every inch of that bloody rock has been gone over with a tooth comb. What the hell do you think you can do?
Then I'll be going alone, Mike said.
Who says you're going alone? We're mates, aren't we?
Then you will.
Of course I will, you big dope. Ugh, cut it out. It won't take much fixing. We don't want nothing but a bit of tucker for you and me and a feed for the two horses. When do you reckon we go?
Tomorrow, if you can get away.
Tomorrow was Friday, and Albert's day off, long dedicated to a cockfight in Wood End.
No, never you mind about that. How early can you start?
Mrs. Fitzhubert's lace parasol could be seen wobbling towards them above the hydrangea hedge, and it was hastily agreed to meet at the stable tomorrow morning at 5:30. Now, at last, the Lakeview lawns were deserted, the marquee dismantled, the trestle tables carried away into storage for another year. A few sleepy starlings were still gossiping in the tallest trees, as the pink silk-shaded lamps of Mrs. Fitzhubert's drawing-room broke into a rosy glow. Out at the Hanging Rock, the long violet shadows were tracing their million-year-old pattern of summer evenings across its secret face, turning their weary blue surge backs upon its magnificent spectacle of gilded peaks slowly darkening upon a turquoise sky. The police party climbed into the waiting vehicle and was driven swiftly towards the familiar comforts of the Wood End Hotel. Constable Bumper, for one, had had a bellyful of the rock and its mysteries and was looking forward, with understandable pleasure, to a couple of beers and a nice juicy steak. In spite of glorious weather and congenial company, it had proved a thoroughly unrewarding day.
In view of the belated evidence of the girl Horton, if evidence it could be called, the search had been immediately intensified, including a recall of the bloodhound who had been furnished with a piece of calico from Miss McCraw's underwear. There seemed no reason to doubt that Edith had actually seen and passed the mathematics teacher making her way up the rock in white calico drawers. The vague, wordless encounter, however, remained unsubstantiated, nor was it ever established if Miss McCraw had experienced an equally fleeting vision of the terrified girl. Some slight disturbance of the bushes and bracken towards the western end of the rock face had been noted as early as last Sunday morning. That was now thought possible that they may have been part of the track taken by Miss McCraw after leaving the rest of the party after lunch. It petered out almost at once, strangely enough, at much the same level of striated rock as certain other faint scratchings and bruisings of the undergrowth at the eastern end, where the four girls may have begun their perilous ascent. All day long, the bloodhound had sniffed and fossicked its delicate way through thick, dusty scrub and sunbaked rocks and stones. The dog, who had proved equally unsuccessful at picking up the scent of the three missing girls earlier in the week, was greatly hampered by the well-meaning army of voluntary searchers, having effaced the first elusive imprints where the hands had rested perhaps on a dusty boulder, a foot on springy moss. The animal, however, did raise some false hopes during Thursday afternoon, by standing for nearly 10 minutes, growling and bristling on an almost circular platform of flat rock, considerably further towards the summit, whereon the magnifying glass disclosed absolutely no sign of any disturbance more recent than the ravages of nature over some hundreds or thousands of years. Bumper, scanning his meagre notes in the failing light of the cab, had hoped that part or all of the teacher's purple silk cape would have been found stuffed into a hollow log, maybe, or under a loose rock. Beats me what the old girl could have done with it, considering hundreds of people have been traipsing about in the scrub ever since Sunday last, let alone the dog. Meanwhile, like most other dwellers on the Mount this evening, Colonel Fitzhubert and his nephew were discussing the recall of the bloodhound. Mrs. Fitzhubert, worn out with the rigours of hospitality, had retired to bed. The colonel was bitterly disappointed about the bloodhound. He had pinned his faith on it from the beginning and felt almost personally let down by its failure to come up with a clue.
"Upon my word," he remarked to his nephew over the dinner table, "I'm beginning to think this thing's gone too far for dogs, or anything else. Be a week this coming Saturday since those poor girls disappeared. Have a glass of port? Most likely dead as mutton by now at the bottom of one of those infernal precipices."
The old boy appeared so genuinely concerned that Mike was tempted to confide his plans for tomorrow's expedition to the Hanging Rock. Aunt, however, would be sure to raise 1,000 objections. After fiddling in silence with the walnuts, he asked if he could have the Arab for the day on Friday.
"It's Albert's day off, you know, and he says he wants to take me for a fairly long ride."
"By all means. Where do you think of going?"
Always a half-hearted liar, even in trifles, Mike muttered something about the camel's hump.
"Splendid. Grundle knows this country like the back of his hand. He'll see you get some good soft going for a gallop. If it wasn't for my Rose Show committee tomorrow afternoon, I might have joined you myself."
"God bless the Rose Show.
And don't be late for dinner.
the colonel added. You know how your aunt fusses. Mike did know and promised faithfully to be back at Lakeview by 7, at least.
Which reminds me, said his uncle, you and I are expected for lunch and tennis at Government Cottage on Saturday.
Lunch and tennis,
the nephew repeated, wondering inwardly how long it would take himself and Albert to get as far as the pool at the picnic grounds.
Have a peach, my boy, or some of this infernal jelly stuff. Women have no idea of household organization.
Mike, who had been wandering on the rock under the moon, was jerked back to the concrete reality of the lamp-lit dining table.
It's the same thing every summer. On the night of your aunt's garden party, these confounded leftovers, scraps of cold turkey, jelly, masquerading as dinner. High tea, more like. Now, when we used to go camping at Bombala, I made it my personal responsibility to arrange for the servants to...
If you'll excuse me, Uncle, said Mike, rising, I think I'll turn in without waiting for coffee. We're making an early start in the morning.
All right, my boy, enjoy yourself. Better ask cook to fix you an early breakfast. Nothing like bacon and eggs before a gallop. Good night.
Good night, sir. Eggs, porridge. According to Albert, there wasn't even fresh water on the hanging rock. 7. A restless windy night on the mount was followed by a calm, windless dawn, with residents still asleep in brass bedsteads under silken coverlets, waking to the tinkle of fern-fringed streams and the scent of the late flowering petunias. On the colonel's lake, the water lilies were just beginning to open as Mike let himself out of the French windows of his room and crossed the croquet lawn, heavy with dew, where his aunt's peacock was taking an early breakfast. For the first time since the events of last Saturday, he felt almost light-hearted. In such an exquisitely ordered world, the hanging rock and its sinister implications were a nightmare, thrust aside. In the avenue of chestnuts, birds were awake and calling, hens cackling from a fowl yard. A puppy barked with joyous insistence on rousing the entire neighbourhood to greet the new day. A thin curl of smoke rose from the Fitzhubert kitchen where a servant was already making up the fire. Michael, suddenly aware that he had gone without breakfast, hoped that Albert had remembered to fix up some lunch. Arrived at the stables, he found the coachman tightening up the girth of the white pony.
"Good morning," said Michael in his pleasant English voice, the upper-class Englishman's ritual good morning to any human being encountered before 9 a.m., from Bond Street to the Blue Nile. Albert's response was equally characteristic of his class and country.
"Hi, you. Hope you had the sense to get yourself a cuppa."
"It doesn't matter," said Michael, whose knowledge of tea-making was limited to a spirit lamp and silver tea-strainer in his Cambridge rooms. "I brought my flask filled with brandy and matches. You see, I am beginning to know something about the bush. Was there anything else?"
Albert gave him a fatherly grin. "Only our tucker in the billy with a couple of mugs and a clasp knife, some clean rags, and a drop of iodine. You never know what we might find once we start looking.
Geez, don't look so bloody miserable. It's your own idea.
And 2 lots of chaff. You can tie this one on your saddle.
Whoa there, Lancer. He's a bit lively first thing in the morning, aren't you, old boy? Right, let's get off."
Out on the steep chocolate road, several other households beside Lakeview were astir. With smoke,
rising from the chimneys in preparation for brass hot water cans and trays of early morning tea. The Fitzhuberts and their friends were a smug little community, well served. A sprinkling of Collins Street doctors, two Supreme Court judges, an Anglican bishop, several lawyers with tennis-playing sons and daughters, enjoying good food, good horses, and good wine. Pleasant, comfortable people for whom the current Boer War was the most catastrophic event since the flood, and Queen Victoria's approaching jubilee a world-shattering occasion to be celebrated by champagne and fireworks on the lawns. The two young men on horseback passed a groom sluicing himself at a pump before an ornate wooden stable, admired by Michael as artistic, dismissed by Albert as fancy crap. A stubbly-faced milkman jogging along in a two-wheeled cart. That poor cow was fined in Wood End last week for watering his milk. A housemaid sweeping the steps of a trellised veranda. A gravelled drive bordered by six-foot delphiniums. A chained invisible dog barking its lungs out behind a hedge of rambler roses. The road wound its charming, leisurely way between sleeping gardens still heavy with dew and shadowed by the upper mountain slopes. Swathes of virgin forest ran right down to an immaculate tennis lawn, an orchard, a row of raspberry canes. The lush, luxuriant gardens were unlike anything Michael had seen in England. There was a heartbreaking innocence about them, a sort of casual gaiety that proclaimed them pleasure gardens, redeeming the undistinguished architecture of red-roofed houses set amongst willow and maple, oak and elm. The rich volcanic soil on which roses glowed all summer long with an almost tropical brilliance was watered by innumerable mountain streams. Cunningly deployed, here a ferny grotto, there a pool of goldfish spanned by a rustic bridge, a tea house above a miniature waterfall. Mike was enchanted by this strangely favoured country where palms, delphiniums and raspberry canes grew side by side. No wonder his uncle hated returning to Melbourne at the end of the summer.
"Costs a packet to live up here among the knobs," Albert was saying. "Look at the staff we keep at Lakeview. Me at the stables, Mr. and Mrs. Cutler down at the gardener's lodge, cook and a couple of girls in the house, to say nothing of the bloody rose garden and four or five damn good horses eating their heads off all year round." Mike, who had never troubled to inquire into his Australian relations finances, was more interested in looking over a trim privet hedge at a flower bed ablaze with purple and yellow pansies. Their scent, drifting out onto the road, was somehow the perfect accompaniment to the swimming colour and light of the waking day.
"What's the name of them thing gummy bobs?" Albert asked.
"Smell good, don't they? Pansies, that's right. They was my kid sister's favourite flowers. Poor little thing. I hope she has a garden of her own now. As far as I know, some old geezer took a fancy to her a few years ago, and that's all I ever heard. Tell you the truth, I only seen her once after she left the orphanage. She was a good kid, though. A bit like me. Wouldn't stand no nonsense from nobody."
While they were talking, Albert had pulled Lancer over to the right into a narrow lane bordered on one side by a stretch of forest, on the other by an old moss-encrusted orchard where ducks in the long grass made the horses shy. Here, the homely sights and sounds of village life were left behind. They entered the green gloom of the forest.
cuts off a good 5 miles this way. There's a rough sort of track somewhere along here that takes us right down over the other side of the mount. The remainder of the journey was travelled without further conversation. The track, turning and twisting among